The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology-themed podcast. I'm your host, Jody Green, with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And today, I'm sans co-host because I'm actually going to share with you an interview that I recorded earlier this year. Usually, like let's say 99% of the time, we record a podcast, we edit it, and we release it in the same week. So it's really not like our team to wait so long to release an interview. However, when I sat down to Zoom and interviewed Dr. Ana Velez a few months ago, I had no idea that my co-host Mike would be taking us on a multi-part journey of Napoleon versus the insects. And if you've been with us through this year, you will know that we've been alternating Napoleon episodes with our scheduled episodes. So I do apologize to Ana. Thank you for being so patient with me. We are going to air this today. Many of our listeners know that I work for the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Unlike my co-host, Mike Scavarla, who works on campus in the Department of Entomology at Penn State, and Jonathan Larson, who works on campus at the Department of Entomology at the University of Kentucky, I am not in the Department of Entomology at UNL. I actually work for Nebraska Extension, and I'm located in a county office about an hour away from UNL's East Campus, so I rarely get to interact socially or regularly with other entomologists. I don't get to interact with students, and sometimes I'm just really the only bug person around. For the past few years, though, I've worked with people from the Department of Entomology on a seminar committee. The department head there, Dr. Ruberson, he asked me a few years ago to be part of this committee, and I jumped at it because, one, I wanted to be part of a team, and two, because I got to have a voice to invite speakers to a seminar. So for those of you who don't know, many departments, not just entomology, will have department seminars, and so they host these talks or showcase speakers. It's usually once a week on a certain day. And you can bring in speakers that are internal for the university, also in the department, in the school, from the community, and also then intercollegiate, nationally and internationally. So speakers may include students, researchers, industry professionals, government entomologists, and many interdisciplinary individuals. It's a great way for students to see what kind of jobs they may seek after graduation, getting to see entomologists in different roles. They may be able to find a mentor through the seminar, or they can find a new opportunity. If they are interested in continuing on to grad school, they may find a new advisor in a different location, different university. This seminar is also a class for students, so it's really great because they enroll for it and then they get graded, usually pass or fail, based on their research proposal or an extension type presentation. They get together as a class and they provide feedback for each other. They get to introduce each other, they get to offer advice or suggestions of content, clarity, and the aesthetics of the slide. It's a really good way for students to practice communicating science to other people. It helps them present in professional meetings and also helps them talk to the media and for radio and to present why their science is important. If I can think of a positive thing that came out of all the Zoom usage provided by COVID-19 and the pandemic, it was the opportunity to invite outside speakers. The only downfalls were probably time zones and technology, but we had some really great people from all over the world. So if you're part of a university or college, or you're a listener that just has a really keen interest in a certain topic, you know, find a place or department that specializes in that, and I'm sure they will have some kind of seminar series that you can listen to webinars or view recordings or even go to the departments if possible. I try to commit a few hours each week to learning something new. you know, that whole learn something new every day, but mostly I feel like I'm just forgetting things every day. What I like to learn are things outside my field. I know one of the things I'm doing now is listening to the Ohio State University. They have some really great pollinator webinars. Find out what you like. There is going to be a place you can get information from. I mean, researchers and scientists, we love to share our passion. So if you have something you're passionate about and you want to learn more, there's going to be some really cool ways to learn. If you have any questions about that, let me know. But, you know, speakers will often flash up their contact slide at the end with their email address or their Twitter handle, and they truly welcome questions and comments. I've met some really cool people this way, and I just really want to pass that on. But anyway, let's get on with our interview.
My name is Ana Maria Vélez Arango, and I'm an assistant professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
What do you do as an assistant professor?
I have a lab on insecticide toxicology or insect toxicology, and a lot of our research focuses on biotech, so BT crops and RNAi technologies, but we're also starting to explore more of the classical insecticides and trying to understand how insects respond and adapt, both beneficial and target insects. And I guess in my research, I try to answer questions that go from molecular to the organism to the population. So right now we're working with three insects. So we have research with monarch butterflies, trying to understand how mixtures of pesticides affect monarchs' survival at sublethal concentrations. We have some work with the Western cone rootworm on trying to understand how RNA interference work on them. So how the double-stranded RNA, that is what it triggers RNA interference, enters the cell. And then the other part is I started working with Justin McMicken on the soybean goldmedge, that it's a new pest of corn. So we are trying to understand population genetics. That way, as we move forward, start learning more about which chemistries will work on soybean goldmedge, start knowing how these population genetics will affect susceptibility to pesticides.
It seems like your work can encompass so many different areas. You know, you're talking about like crop pests, and you're talking about like pollinators, migrators, beautiful butterflies, and then also like this brand new pest of soybean, all the different crops, all the different plants, insecticides, and then the organism, so many different areas that you can be involved in. I know I had to do a lot of research just to even talk to you because I'm all like applied organism and maybe behavior, but there's so many things that are interconnected that you're working on. I see, you know, your name and your lab come up at the end of all research talks. Like everyone always thanks you and has acknowledgements. So you can be involved in essentially every project.
Yeah. So depending on what it is. So the cool and sometimes hard part of toxicology is that, and different toxicologists will have different experiences, but toxicology is encompass a lot of different disciplines. So I guess in my case, I work a lot in the molecular level. So we can do things in molecular biology. I will talk first in general in toxicology, and then I will focus on like what I do. So in toxicology, you can go from like the chemistry and interactions in the chemistry to molecular biology, and then move to the physiology of the insect, to then move to what is happening in terms of behavior. And then from there, you can move to what is happening to the population. And from that, you can even move to landscape and how different things are interacting. So that's in general, so a toxicologist will have an understanding of a couple of disciplines. In my case, what I have mainly focused on my career is molecular biology and genetics. So in my PhD, I did a lot of work with what they call, what you learn in high school on Mendelian genetics. So Mendelian genetics, but applied to insecticide resistance. So to understand how resistant alleles, how kind of are distributed in a population, to put it in a way. At the molecular level, for example, with RNA interference, we're trying to understand how it works. So even that would be more like cellular biology. So what's happening in the cell when the double-stranded RNA enters, what happens in the membrane, how it's moving from cell to cell. That one is a little bit harder for a lot of people, even for me when I was starting. So you need kind of like a switch of mind, because a lot of it is just, you're just, I call it in a way like imaginary science, because you did all of these experiments and now you need to think, if it's a cell, what's happening in the cell, and make a lot of connections. So sometimes with those experiments take a while to interpret, because you get the results and it's like, I don't even know what this means. So you need to sit there for a while, and it sometimes can take you a week to kind of interpret what's happening. And then the other part is like, with that information that we get from molecular biology and genetics, we can maybe predict or understand what's going to happen at the organismal level. So how it's going to maybe affect behavior, or how it's going to affect the physiology of the organism. And then from there, you can also do population studies. So in case with, when I did things with fall armyworm, resistance to the BT protein CRY1F. So trying to understand how is that going to affect the population. So carrying that resistant alleles will affect the fitness of the population. And then you do certain mathematical calculations that you can estimate if the population is going to grow or not. Sounds complicated. It's just a lot of different steps that you end up doing to understand that part. So in my research, that's what I like to do. So understand more at the molecular and the genetic level what's happening. And then from there, have a general understanding what's happening to the organism. And then move to do predictions on more ecological concepts of fitness and mating and things like that, to predict what's going to happen with the population. So is that population going to go huge, or is going to get smaller, or is going to remain the same? And then, so it takes from a thinking that it goes from really basic biology or to then try to apply it. I guess when I'm training, and even for me as training as a grad student, that was hard, because I came more from the basic. From my major was in biology, and I had a hard time thinking in the big picture, like what these mean in terms of agriculture, of a farmer. In other cases, it's the opposite. If the student comes more from an agronomy background, that is the applied side, maybe they might struggle to get into the nitty gritty of the details of the basic biology. But I guess for me, I need to understand from basic biology to have a general understanding what's happening in the agro ecosystem, to put it in a way. So because of that, no matter what, I have the tools that allow me to work with any insect, from a pollinator to an insect pest. So it's the same methods. You just apply to the different insect, but you also need to start thinking as an entomologist, okay, what is the biology? What is the difference between a butterfly and a fly? What is the difference between a root feeding coleopteran compared to a dipteran? But what's interesting is that sometimes you find that you can find connections. And when you work with one insect, then you can think, oh, maybe something similar is happening with this other insect. So I guess in my case right now, I'm focusing on those three insects. But in theory, I could work with any other insect and use those same tools.
So the reason why this is RNAi interference so important is to protect crops and protect food and minimize pesticide use against the pests of crops. So some of the research that you did was to find out how that affects that population and if they can become resistant to it.
So right now, that's what we're trying to understand. In the past, what I did, first, let's step back one step before.
Okay, teach
me. So RNA interference is now more like over the last almost 15 years being explored for crop improvement and for a management of pests. But before that, this technique had been used and it still is being used to understand gene function. So that one is used both for like basic molecular understanding of what is the role of certain genes, and now for pest management. What is good with RNA interference is that it's really specific to the target pests. So compared to other, for example, neurotoxins like neonicotinoids or any organophosphate or pyrethroids, those have a wider range. It can affect multiple insects, mm-hmm. including pollinators and other beneficial organisms. With RNAi, we can be super specific. So for example, with the newest product that will come into the market for Western corn rootworm, the only species that it affect is some species within the same subtribe. So we are getting from like a technology that affects almost all orders of insects or a couple of orders of insects to a subtribe from an order. So it's super specific. So in a way, it's really environmentally friendly. And then for RNAi, they're exploring two strategies for delivery. So one is expressing it on plants. So for Western corn rootworm, is expressed on the corn roots and is actually expressing the whole plant. And then the other one is in sprayables. The problem with double-strand RNA is that it's relatively unstable in their environment. So there is different companies that are trying to explore ways to make it more stable in the environment. The research that I actually did during my postdoc and at the beginning of being an assistant professor, one was trying to understand if double-stranded RNA or RNAi for Western corn rootworm will have effect on honeybees. So that one, actually, I had to learn to work with honeybees and learn how to be a nurse bee. I reared my larvae in the lab and exposed them to the double-stranded RNA and didn't generate anything. It was really safe for honeybees. And then from that, I actually use RNAi for understanding mode of action of a different pesticide for a while. And then move to understand the mode of action of RNAi. So what will be the effect of different genes on the insect? What are the dose range that you need? We even had a collaboration with what it was, Dagger Sciences, and they expressed things in plants. And we did the test here. So with RNAi, what is cool is like you can find, we were exploring for a while this strategy in that we didn't give them to the larva to generate mortality, but we actually gave it to the adults and it prevented the adults from producing eggs that were viable. So in this strategy, the idea will be that the females will not produce any viable offspring.
Did you feed it to them?
Yep.
Yep.
So it was crazy that we just fed them and then somehow we still don't know the mechanism. It gets into the egg, the embryo never develops. So we actually did the experiments. At the end, the problem is that the plants didn't express enough for the beetles to have a response. But it was really cool. But it was more like if you're thinking working with a company, that discovery part that is trying to understand how those works, how much will you need. And then at the end, we went to the plant expression. Mm. It didn't work. But we learned a lot about how RNAi works. And then another part of the research that I did before was with a different lethal gene and trying to understand what would be the effect on the offspring and more of the sublethal effects of those genes. So that was kind of more like what I have done so far. In 2018, I cannot recall on the top of my head, but there was the first report that resistance could evolve to RNAi. So since then, we're trying to understand how field populations respond to RNAi and what is the likelihood. They will develop resistance with plant-incorporated protectants that are all these transgenic crops like corn and soybeans. We know that the insect will eventually evolve resistance. We want to do with these technologies is to try to make them last longer. So how they will evolve resistance ahead of time, we can find strategies. That way they don't evolve resistance as quick. So something that I did in the past was to understand what are the genes involved in the processing inside the cell. Now we are trying to understand how the double-stranded RNA gets inside the cell. So what are the genes or proteins that are involved in getting it inside of the cell? That's starting to be really tricky and hard to understand, but we're getting some ideas of how it works.
Would you say you have times where there's like you discover something that you didn't know before and you like run around the lab really excited?
Yeah, I think. Yeah, but it's like sometimes it's like a lot of times it's not that way. So it's like you find something and you're like, I don't understand what this means. And then you start kind of like making the connections and then find out like, oh, this is really cool. Anyway, when I got into the genes, so I know that the people that started doing this parental RNAi work, I kind of like inherited and continued doing the process. But the first time that they found it was like mind blowing. Like, this is just crazy. And yeah, like you just get super excited and go to your advisor. We just find these. This is so crazy. In one, I felt actually like a mad scientist. So one of these parental genes is called Hunchback. So what it does is that it affects the segmentation of the larva. So basically you have like a hunchback larva that is kind of all curled and their mandibles are...
Is this the corn root, Western corn rootworm?
Yeah. And I can send you a picture. Like they just look all weird. Like, yeah, like a hunchback. Like they have the hunchback and like they are kind of like big head and a smaller body and they are really short. So you can see in the egg that they are inside, but they cannot come out. So you eventually can open the egg and see the larva because their mouth parts are just messed up and they can't get out. And the larva is still alive. So you, in that case, there was another postdoc in that time and said, those are pictures that look from a mad scientist because you're just generating these messed up larva that are, I didn't like that gene that much. I like a different one that just didn't allow to develop the embryo. Mm. But still, it was kind of cool to see, like, this is crazy that when you just knock down one gene, it just generates so much damage in the development of the embryo.
Are there things you've learned studying insect genetics that can relate to human genetics and some medical innovations?
Oh, yeah, no, like this is super, a lot of the genes in insects will do the same in humans. And how RNAi works in insects is the same way that it works in humans. So there is RNA therapeutics for different, like for rare diseases, rare genetic diseases. I know they have one for hemophilia that they develop. So yeah, I cannot completely understand what they are doing because in some ways it's similar. And I can also understand what are the issues that they might find. Because, for example, in insects, RNAi doesn't work well by feeding in all insects because it can get degraded and there is other factors. And in humans, it's kind of the same thing. We also have enzymes and things that will degrade that double-stranded RNA. But no, but there is sometimes that you feel excited. It's like, this is so cool. Like, we just find that this gene plays a role in this machinery. And but the problem is, like, only two or three people will get excited with you because the rest of them... I share with others and they're like, I don't know what you're talking about. But like, for example, with grad students that are working in the same or others that work in the same area, you tell them and like they get as excited as you do. Like, oh yeah, this is super cool. But it's just a couple of people that gets excited.
So the grad students that come into your lab, how do you choose them or how do they choose you? And what are typically their backgrounds? Are they entomologists or genetics or molecular biology?
Okay, so I have had so far 5 grad students. Okay, so let's start with the first ones. So I first had 2 master's students. So one, it was a biology student that I met when I went to give, when I was a postdoc, a talk in Colombia. And she sounded really curious and interested in molecular biology. So yeah, I contacted her and then brought her here from Colombia. Now she graduated in 2019 and she's now doing a PhD in Germany in one of the Max Plancks. Then another student was actually from agricultural biochemistry from Iowa State. So he ended up doing more of field population stuff, but had to have an understanding of the molecular side. So that combination of agricultural biochemistry was really good because he understood the chemistry, the molecular biology, but then with the agricultural part, also understand the effects in the field. Then I have other 2 grad students that they took my class, my undergrad class, Toxins in the Environment, and they started working as undergrad students in my lab, and then I ended up recruiting them to stay. So one of them had a major in biology, and the other one was from environmental studies. So he actually doesn't have a lot of entomology background, but has more of an understanding of how chemicals and toxins move in the environment and what are the effects that they can have in an ecosystem. So I guess it's different backgrounds, and it also depends on the project that with the student that you're having. That I have one more student that she has a background in agronomy and she wants to do things in molecular biology.
That sounds like an interesting class, toxins in the environment. Like,
I really enjoyed teaching that class.
What kind of things do you touch on?
So that one is not only entomology related, but it's more, I give an introduction of toxicology. So some important concepts in toxicology, like what is LC50, that is the lethal concentration that kills 50% of a population. What are the physical and chemical properties that a toxin, or like how that will affect how a toxin moves in the body or in the environment. And then we mainly focus in humans. So how toxins will move in the human body, like what are the factors that will affect that toxin reach the target site, and then some of the things that could happen. So we even go through mutagenesis and carcinogenesis, teratogenesis, and go through a little bit of in each system, what are the things that each or different toxicants can do in the body. And then at the end, we conclude with a little bit of risk assessment, a little bit of some main contaminants, but we can't go through a lot of details because there is not enough time. We also go a little bit into ecotoxicology, and then at the end we do debates. So over the last two times that I taught this class, we did debates on, we pick four topics that are kind of like hot topics. So we pick, it was GMOs in one, the other one was organic versus traditional agriculture in terms of the chemistries that are used. Another one was vaccines, really relevant for today's environment. And I cannot remember what was the other one, but I think was antibiotic use in livestock. Mm. So talking about those things, and then we have, yeah, one that is pro, another one that is against. And they have to do research, but based on research, on peer review information. They have to do the process during the semester. And then at the end, there is a debate. And we have a judging team of grad students that pick which team in the debate wins. So we use actually the same structure of ESAs.
Yeah, I was going to say, this seems like a good preparation and practice for the ESA student debates.
Yeah, but this class is for undergrad, so but it's good for the grad students to see how they how to moderate and then see a debate in progress. Maybe I will invite you to the debates this year.
That would be fun.
I might be jumping around a little bit, but I'd like the listeners to get to know you a little better. If you wouldn't mind sharing something that you shared in a talk that you gave at ESA in 2021. The title of your talk was Small But Mighty, One Latina's Journey in Academia.
I think we learn a lot about you as a person and your background.
So I'll guess I'll summarize really quick. What I presented was a little bit of my journey on how I end up where I am today. So I'm from Colombia in South America, and it's with O, not like Columbia, Missouri. It's Colombia with an O. I grew up in the city of Medellin. And then over there, like, it's one of the most biodiverse countries in the world. So not a lot of kids develop that, but I develop a lot of curiosity of my natural environment and like how everything look. I love picking insects, giant scarabs. I think I talk about, I mentioned that I loved sticked insects. And when I was really little, I told my mom that it was the most beautiful thing I have ever seen. It was a stick insect. So that part kind of, my mom kind of like continued fostering that curiosity for nature. And my grandpa had a farm. So we went and spent like during the summer and Christmas breaks. Keep in mind that Christmas breaks for us is still nice environment. So it's like a spring or a summer in the Midwest. Not even, it's more of a spring because it's not as hot. So I just went and explored. I have I just went on walk and picked things and played with trees and flowers. And yeah, my mom and my family really foster that. And then, so based on that, I decided to study biology. And during my undergrad, I was actually able to do a senior project working in a butterfly garden. And I ended up doing the life cycle of a butterfly that have only been described in 1920s, but the biology has not been explored more. So I ended up doing the life cycle in detail of this butterfly and publishing a paper.
Wow.
Yeah, I was really cool. So it was super, super cool. I felt in a way like a naturalist, because a lot of it was just going into the forest, trying to find the eggs and then bring the eggs to the lab. And the lab was super cool because it was in an island in the middle of a lake. So it was amazing. I missed those times. And then after that, I did a master's in entomology in Colombia. That one, I started getting dabbling more in genetics. And I want to say something. You say that you were not good and you didn't want to do genetics or chemistry. I was actually that way. And I say when I did my undergrad, I will never do anything with genetics or molecular biology. And here I am. So for those maybe listening that are undergrads and are thinking, oh, I will never do that. Don't say that. Yeah, you don't know where life might take you.
Yeah, that's true.
So anyway, I did some work with fall armyworm population genetics in Colombia. So I started getting more into insect pests. And then when I was doing my master's, I met my advisor for my PhD. He went down to Colombia and then he asked me if I wanted to come and do a PhD here. I came here, did a PhD in entomology at the University of Nebraska.
So he went to Colombia, recruited you and brought you back to Nebraska of all places.
Yes. Yeah. Like when you say, do you want to come to Nebraska? I didn't. I thought it was Alaska. So I had to go and check in the map where Nebraska was. So I did my postdoc here in Nebraska.
So when you started your PhD, was that the first time you had been to Nebraska?
Yes. And the first time that I had been in the U.S. and I spoke in English like daily. So I knew English reading and I took classes and you speak in your English class, but that's about it. Like my first real immersion is when I moved here to do my PhD.
Wow, that's amazing.
It was scary and exciting at the same time. So yeah, for my PhD, I work on fall armyworm resistance to Cryo-NF proteins. So Cryo-NF is a protein from the bacteria Bacillus thuringiensis that is expressed on corn plants. But this resistance was from Puerto Rico. So I was even able to travel to Puerto Rico during my PhD to collect fall armyworm there and bring it to Nebraska. And then I also, I have a funny story or scary
yes.
story. So they sent me to Texas to collect some fall armyworm there because I was trying to see if those resistant alleles from Puerto Rico were present in the U.S. But fall armyworm is only prevalent in Florida and Texas because they don't have diapause. So in Nebraska, they don't show every year and they only show for a little bit during the summer. So we have collaborators in Florida that send us the caterpillars, but then I went to Texas and they send us to Corpus Christi. Anyway, I was with another technician. Our car died in the middle of nowhere. A state trooper picked us up and said, this is a really dangerous area. Shouldn't be here. We jump in the car, in his car, like full of guns everywhere. He's like, I have all of these here because this is really dangerous. Anyway, we ended up just all paranoid and we made it to our destination, but it was kind of an interesting experience going there.
Dangerous field work.
Yeah, I guess for me, it wasn't as surprising. Like I grew up in Colombia when we still have guerrillas and narcos. So in some ways, I was used to that. Mm. But for the technician, she's from Nebraska and she was a little freaked out by the whole experience.
Do you notice a lot of cultural differences?
There is a lot, but I think it's not as much as for other students maybe coming from India or China. But like some of the cultural differences is in Latin America, we touch a lot. We hug and say hello by giving a kiss. So that was a cultural shock to understand the concept of the bubble people have here. So it's like in Colombia, even if you just met someone, it's okay if you touch their shoulder, for example. And even you just met them and you greet them with a kiss in the cheek. And that doesn't happen here. You need to get used to that. You don't touch people. You don't kiss people. That's, I guess, one of the biggest one for me. The other one that was interesting is that for us, we actually eat a meal, a big meal for lunch. And then for a supper or dinner, it's just something really light. So kind of like getting adjusted in here, you eat something more light for lunch and then dinner is more of a heavier meal. Mm-hmm. That was another one. Another one that I missed a lot is that we always have fresh juice for lunch and for dinner. Like in Colombia, in any restaurant, they always have freshly made juice of different fruits. So
do you need a juicer?
Oh, I have stuff.
Okay.
No, I have it. But I think, yeah, the biggest shocker, I will say, for a lot of the Latin American students is understanding the personal bubble. Because you learn it really quick when people start getting uncomfortable. If you get too close or you try to give them a kiss. In the talk, I talk about some of the challenges that I have faced, some of the things I have found that help. So, for example, some of the things is imposter syndrome. In my case, is really prevalent in some ways because I grew up and I think I mentioned that in my talk, in the narco culture, where like the only thing women can be smart and you shouldn't be interested in science and you should only be pretty. And if you're pretty and stupid, even better. So I kind of never fit that culture. But also in some ways you get, I don't know if it's the system or if just I'm unlucky, but getting people a lot of micro and macroaggressions that kind of like shake your confidence.
Your mother was very supportive of you and really fostered that love for nature. What do you think it was about her, if that was not something that was typical or valued, why was that important to her?
I will think that I'm just kind of putting myself in her shoes, and maybe I should ask her, but I think she saw my passion for nature and insects, and she said like that's what she likes and gets excited about, so I will foster that instead of trying to just shut it down. And yeah, I will say just she fostered all our curiosities. So he's like, yeah. My younger brother was interested in music. So that's what she fostering him. So I think from her point of view, it's more like really observing your child of what they like and then fostering that on them.
Like valuing that individualization too, like that everyone's an individual and this is what makes you
happy. Yeah.
That's nice. That's good. A lot of families that have, you're expected to, you know, be a doctor or be a lawyer. It's, oh no, you're not going to get a job. And they veer you away. So I really admire the parents and the people that encourage you to follow your passion.
Actually, when I was going to study biology, my dad had a serious talk, but I think it was good, kind of like a reality check. He just say, as a biologist, your likelihood to have a good job, it's not huge. I will pay for your undergrad and I'll support you, but I just want you to know that that's reality, that in a country like Colombia, being a biologist is not the most profitable thing to do anyway, but I still support it.
Yeah. What do they think now?
They are proud. They would like if I was there closer to my parents in Colombia, but they are proud of what I have done.
Yeah.
I don't think they ever imagine like that I will end up having a good job in being a biologist and actually doing biology. Mm-hmm. Because I'm sure like what they thought, like, oh yeah, she's going to study biology, but will end up doing something at it for a living.
Like, do they know how successful you are and how how good you are at what you do?
I don't know. They don't know English. So I'm not sure. I guess maybe with some of the invitations to international conference, they are like, oh, wow, that sounds cool and important. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, so I was talking about the challenges. So I talk about imposter syndrome, but I think that's is really prevalent in minorities and in women. And in part is because of the culture, your experiences. So that has been a challenge for me that I have worked on, working to respond to micro and macro aggression.
When we were talking about, so going to microaggressions, how would you define that? We talk about this a lot in diversity training, but are those the small unconscious ones?
Yeah. So those are, and I will say macro can also be unconscious, but they have a little bit more weight. But it's just those little things. I think there is a commercial that I was looking recently, and it's unconscious messages that you get since you're little. So it's like, oh, you fight like a girl, or you run like a girl. And it's kind of diminishing. You're smart like a girl, or things like that. You start kind of like, I'm not enough. And no matter what I do, I will never be enough. And I got this job because I was just lucky, not because I'm good. Just because you get all of these messages during your childhood. Oh, girls are not as smart. You shouldn't pursue a career in science. Girls should look pretty, but shouldn't be as smart. And shouldn't talk back and defend themselves. Or like, for example, for me, like when you have an accent and they say, I can't understand you, you should go back to your country. I guess maybe that one is not unconscious. Yeah, I don't know. Like, or some microaggressions, for example, that those just really hurt is when I started in the university, I had an administrator telling me, you have done all your degrees in the University of Nebraska, and I don't understand why they hire you, and you're not going to be successful at this job. So no matter what, like, that's going to affect your confidence.
Right. And that's terrible, because that's not going to set you up to do anything positive if they're part of the university.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Yeah. I don't know. A lot of it, I think, is unconscious, and like unconscious things that you start noticing that people that doesn't look like you get recognize in ways, even doing less than what you're doing in some ways. So it's like what they say, for example, they have a CV that has a female and a male name, and they tend to pick the male, even both of them have the same qualifications. So a lot of it is just the unconscious things that you start noticing. But I have also, in ways that is good, that I have a husband that is Canadian. He brings up that a lot of it is also my own trauma from previous experiences that people has told me no. So a lot of times for me, it's just kind of like backtrack and say, okay, am I responding or feeling so sensitive about this just because of this special situation, or is more like a cumulative? So in part of like what the strategies I have found to help me deal with imposter syndrome and micro and macroaggressions is a lot of self-reflection and thinking, okay, so thinking, what are your past traumas that are making you react this way? So in my way, it has been a lot of, I come from a culture that is like the macho culture that is really dominant, but in a way I'm kind of like unconsciously I'm in a combative way, but I also at the same time is one to please. So it's like kind of finding those things that like, why are you responding the way that you're responding? That because only this situation, or is just kind of like this adding up to all the other experiences? In the last years, is trying to learn to maybe not fight, but just pick when I want to respond in a kind manner. And to put it in a way, instead of taking all the rocks that are thrown at me and carrying a giant heavy backpack, just giving those rocks back in a kind manner to the other person, and maybe use it as an opportunity for that person to learn of their unconscious biases, and that their words have consequences in how they might make people feel. That's kind of what I'm trying to work on now.
Yeah, that's a good lesson.
And I actually had a conversation with someone that is like, oh, I didn't know that I even say that. And say, yeah, for you, you don't remember that you said it because in your case, it was unconscious, didn't have any weight. But for me or for the other person had a weight that made you feel and you kind of continue ruminating on that for a while. So a lot of it, I think, too, is like when we're talking about inclusion and equity is, I think, as minorities, we also need to, in a kind way, like not in a combative way, try to educate people that certain things are not perceived in a correct manner.
You are a student advisor and a major professor, and you run your lab. What do you think are the toughest aspects of that and maybe the most rewarding?
Okay, the hardest aspects, and I think I'm getting better at it, is that when you're a grad student and even as a postdoc, we're never trained to deal with people. We're not trained to deal with the human component, right? And like I had a lot of, a lot of situations that opened my eyes, like even with undergrads, that undergrads come to you, oh, I'm thinking about killing myself, or my mom just died and I don't know what to do. Like we're never trained. Like you're just freezing. It's like, I don't know what to do in these situations. So more learning about that, that when you're a professor or an advisor, you're not going to only face the research challenges, but personal challenges. Life happens. I heard from a professor once this, during his career, long career, he has had like marriages, births, deaths, divorces, sickness, everything. So those are things that you're not trained of, like how to handle. So that was one of the most challenging, I think, parts of learning that. Another one that was an interesting part, I think, I don't know, maybe for me, when you start, you think that your grad student should be like you. So the way that they're going to be successful is like how you did stuff. But then you realize now every student is different. Every student have different needs, right? So it's kind of figuring out a lot of like even doing research on your students and trying to understand their behaviors and like how you can help them succeed with their own limitations and their own skills, right? And even trying to highlight what are their skills and what they need to work on. So a lot of having like tough conversations sometimes is like, hey, you're not performing the best way. What is going on? Are you having any personal issues or you need to work harder on these because if not, you can't graduate. If you want to get a job, you should adjust the way that maybe you communicate with people. Or anyway, all of those little things have been challenging, but at the same time rewarding, because once you see that your students in their own way, like just take their projects in that, even in different directions that you didn't even think about it, and they start showing progress and that they are growing and like develop more of that scientific thinking. That's, I guess those two are kind of like the most challenging, but at the same time, the most rewarding. So that human component. And another part that I have found really hard is having so many responsibilities and kind of like juggling all of those things too. I need to get money and publish and teach and mentor my students. And yeah, sometimes you get like different pockets of money and you need to figure out how you're going to pay for something, or things broke down, or anyways, there is so many things that happen. At some point, you just get used to every day is an adventure. Anything can happen.
When you first came to Nebraska, was that the first time you had traveled internationally?
To a different speaking country, yes.
And then since you've traveled a lot of places, right?
So during my PhD, I actually went and gave a talk. So I went to Puerto Rico and I went to give a talk in Mexico. And then in 2019, I went to Paris in France and to China.
And
to different cities in China.
What were those trips like?
They were really cool. So both of them were really cool and interesting. So both of them were for work. So the one to Paris was for the OECD, the Organization for Economic Development and Cooperation.
Wow.
So it was, so in some ways was really cool because I have an uncle that lives in Paris. So it was kind of like an opportunity to see him too. Mm-hmm. And he can show me the city. So it's Paris, for anybody that has traveled there, is just a magical city. It's just so much history that is really cool. And then the conference was actually especially cool too, because you feel kind of, in a way it is, like in the United Nations. So it's a giant room, like in a circle. And then there is microphones and the names of different countries. So we had regulatory people from different countries around the world. So someone representing Germany, someone representing Austria, Australia, Argentina, Canada, the US. So what we were talking about is how RNAi products that are sprayables should be regulated. So I gave a talk, and there was other different experts that also gave talks. And there was a lot of, just conversations globally, how these things should be regulated. And for regulators, representative of each country, to then go back to their countries and see how they are going to regulate these type of products. Is this going to be like a genetically modified crop, or is it going to be more like a synthetic insecticide, or more as a biological? So those conversations were really cool, because then I got to see how different countries approach regulations. So one thing that I will never forget is that in the US, they show something is safe, and then they are safe until you no longer can say that it's safe, to put it in a way. While in Germany, is the opposite. Everything is dangerous until you can prove that it's safe.
Wow.
So those different approaches, society will look at products in different ways. So that was the trip to France.
And how did you get chosen and invited to go to that particular meeting?
So for that particular meeting, I was contacted by someone that works in regulation from Bayer Crop Sciences. Mm-hmm. I actually didn't know him, but he heard my name from someone that they say, hey, who we should... And I think it was mainly because of the work that I did with honeybees, and that I also understand really well the technology and how I work a lot with different companies. So someone gave him my name, and then he contacted me and said, do you want to go to France to give a talk on this and be part of this discussion? And there is actually, like a whole series of papers that came from this meeting. So it was really, really interesting.
That's a big deal.
I don't know how I got selected, but they invited me. And I will go. And it was a really, really eye-opening and interesting experience. Being in the organism, you're actually affecting how a technology is going to be regulated around the world. Yeah. So that's, I guess, one of the highlights in my career, that I was able to be part of that. Mm-hmm. I was trusted that what I understand from the science was valued for me to present there. So,
and then in China?
So in China was, there is a professor at Kansas State University, Dr. Kun Jiansu. He has a big interaction with Shanxi University in China. And then every year they try to bring a couple of professors from the US or other places to have a discussion and a symposium on RNAi. So I have interacted with him in the past, and so he invited me. And there was, a couple of different experts from the US and from UK and Belgium. And so they treat us super well. They took us even for trips, and we ended up going to a meeting on IPM and presenting. So I ended up being two presentations there. I will say, all the Chinese students and the professors, they are wonderful hosts. They take care of you in a way that is just amazing. They treat us really, really well, and like immerse us in the culture too, and like the food, and explain different things. So that was, just wonderful.
Oh, that's good. So you're very active with a lot of young professional committees and organizations. Can you talk about some of those involvements and what they mean to you and why they're important to be involved?
When I was a postdoc, I ended up being part of the Early Career Professionals Committee at ESA. I guess in part, I felt that postdocs in some ways are kind of ignored. In our department, it was like the students get emails, the faculty get emails, and then we don't belong in any place. We needed opportunities for professional development. So I got really passionate to be kind of like advocate and speak up like, hey, we need more opportunities for like training and leadership and highlight what early career professionals are doing, because that's, I guess, the point where they need to boost their careers too and where they decide where they want to get. And in some way too, in my case, thinking in the leaky pipeline for women, that I think is one area or like one part of a career path where a lot of people might leave. So trying to find ways too that we can help retain more females in entomology.
I think it's been very successful, the program there.
Yeah, I think so. It's getting there.
They have a lot of workshops. Maybe they should do one with personnel.
I completely agree. Just that human component is, and I will say for any grad student or postdoc that listens to this podcast, try to get some training in emotional intelligence and how to deal with hard conversations and difficult situations. Because, yeah, once you move up in your career, you find more of those and more things that you will need to think quickly, respond quickly, and in a professional manner.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I was also part of the diversity and inclusion committee for a while. So I'm also, yeah, really interested in diversity and inclusion of any minority. If you're from a different race, or if you're from different sexual orientation or different types of diversity, that we need to be more, I don't know, be more kind and accepting of that everybody's different. But at the same time, all of us are the same. Like, we're human beings.
If you weren't an assistant professor, RNAi genius, you know, what would you want to do, or where would you be?
Huh, that's interesting. So I will just go first to things outside work, how they look. So I am really passionate in general about nature. I like to do things outside, like hiking. I love animals, and I guess, I think I know what I will do. So if I wasn't an assistant professor, I think I will be working in a dog shelter or something with rescuing animals. I have 2 rescue dogs, so they are a big part of my day-to-day. They are silly and a big part of my family. I think when I was a kid, that was one. In Colombia, there is a lot of stray dogs. So my dream was to have to get a giant farm where you can adopt all those dogs. But once you get stray dogs, you realize that it's not as simple, because they have a lot of emotional and issues from when they're mistreated. Anyway, so yeah, I love dogs. I like knitting a lot. I like watching sci-fi stuff. And I also, in the last couple of years, have got really into mindfulness and yoga. And I'm currently doing a yoga teaching training. I guess it has helped me to deal with some of my traumas and things that I have experienced. So thinking more of, like, I have gotten really passionate about mental health of students and how we can help them. An organization that we have on campus, Big Red Resiliency, that tries to, like, promote wellness in students. Connie Baim mentioned that what we need to assume is every student has a mental health issue. So it's finding ways of how we can help them succeed even with those struggles. Yeah, I guess that could be another option. If I was an assistant professor, maybe I will get into counseling or coaching students. Mm-hmm. My own struggle is what it has turned me into, trying to be a good mentor and supporting other females in science, because I guess I felt alone and I didn't have a role model. So hopefully by someone seeing me as someone they can speak to and ask advice, or at least just come and cry and then go and do their research, then like it will inspire them to continue doing science and finding their way to do science with their own personality without losing themselves, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's not that I have figured out. I still struggle with that. I think a lot of students think that because you in some ways made it, you don't have any of those issues. No, I still go through that and like phases that I go, I can't do this and I'm not good enough and I'm not going to be able to continue in this job. And then you go, no, yeah, I'm doing great and I can do it. And then you go, but so it's a roller coaster. Yeah. I haven't figured it out. Mm-hmm. But I still doubt myself all the time. Yeah, someone listening, don't try to think that you're going to fix it. It's always a work in progress. You just learn to better talk yourself out of that rabbit hole.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me. I've always admired you and I've wanted to interview. I just didn't really know what you did and just the depth of all the things you know. I just know that you are definitely the type of role model and professor I would have wanted when I was younger. So I knew that you would have lots to provide for our listeners. So if anyone wanted to find you or your lab or any information about you, where could they do that?
They can go to the UNL website, and I also have my lab webpage.
Is it VelezToxicologyLab.com?
Yep.
Okay, I'll put that in show notes. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners today?
No, just that be yourself, trust your gut, and you can do it. And yeah, just think you're a human being with all your issues. You can make it no matter what.
So again, thanks to Ana Velez for speaking with me today. If you would like to find our show notes, they can be found on arthro-pod.blogspot.com. And if you want to find our show on Twitter, we are at @arthro_podshow. If you'd like to find me, Jody Green, on Twitter, I'm at @JodyBugsMeUNL. And please come back and join us again for another Arthropod adventure with me and my co-hosts. We'll have a few more Napoleon versus the insects, and then we'll get back to other buggy things. But until then, have a great time. Enjoy the summer. Get outside and come back and see us again soon.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time. Same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.